other mechanisms also began to arise in various areas of the region, contributing to what is referred to as multilateralism. This obviously has roots in the dynamics of U.S. interventionism, such as the Pan-American vision they have always sought to impose on our continent. Since the late 19th century, they aimed to create a sort of Pan-American Union, which was more about formalizing their Monroe Doctrine logic and hegemony over our countries. But it never really materialized into a specific space. Well, after that, we move into the realm of Latin American and Caribbean affairs, and even at the continental level, we encounter what we know as the OAS, the Organization of American States, which fundamentally serves the interests of the United States. Additionally, as we approach the end of the century, we see the emergence of various other organizations, particularly in Latin America and the Caribbean. This trend of multilateralism is solidifying in this century with significant mechanisms such as UNASUR, ALBA, Mercosur, Petrocarib, the Caribbean Community, the AEC, and a collection of over 15 different types of spaces, culminating in the recent establishment of CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Thus, we have a scenario where multiple mechanisms of various kinds exist, some with economic or merely commercial characteristics within the framework of neoliberalism, including free trade agreements, which also serve as forms of multilateral mechanisms, among others.
Well, there is a clear distinction between the interventionist policy of the United States and its dominance, and it must be stated as such, even if it's cloaked in a guise of multilateralism, support and cooperation across all areas, which is quite different from true multilateralism. This concept fundamentally arises in countries that possess a social system aiming for sovereignty and independence, striving for their own development and self-sustainability from a governance perspective, right? How is this contradiction evident today, for instance, with the organizations we have?
Well, of course, undoubtedly, the older mechanisms, like the UN, for instance, which has been going through a crisis for several years now, reflect that any mechanism that can be controlled or manipulated, or even unknown, meaning to surpass it through actions, ultimately becomes a space for U.S. intervention. If we consider the case of the UN, how many times have different decisions been made from there, such as the one that condemned the United States to pay $16 billion to Sandinista Nicaragua when a complaint was filed in The Hague? Remember when that happened? And on the other hand, as you rightly point out, there are mechanisms that have aimed to consolidate, let's say, or move towards true sovereignty and independence against these powers, which in the most particular case of our region is the United States, but also includes the influence of Europe and those who have experienced various forms of attacks from this imperial logic that the United States embodies. A concrete example is UNASUR. UNASUR, which at one point managed to function as a genuine multilateral mechanism that contributed to regional political coexistence with governments of differing ideologies, played a crucial role in resolving various types of conflicts, didn't it? However, the United States, through its actions, even with supportive leaders like Mauricio Macri in Argentina or Bolsonaro at one point, effectively led to the extinction of UNASUR, which has nearly vanished. In fact, in the case of Ecuador, the headquarters was removed, and so on. Therefore, there exists a dispute between two views of multilateralism that are undoubtedly very prominent in the current landscape of our complex and troubled planet, where the weight of U.S. interests often shapes international dynamics. In the meantime, the logic of multilateralism has been strengthening. Let's remember what Hugo Chavez emphasized in his time. Multipolarity, right? This means the ability to create various types of space globally, where international relations are not dictated by who has the most powerful military or the strongest investment, but rather by the needs for healthy coexistence. we would say, in the best sense, among countries facing similar challenges and, above all, seeking to break free from the heavy chains of hegemony, primarily that of the United States.
Indeed, it's the hegemony of the United States. We'll take a break now, Nayar, and we'll be right back. We're back here on Black and White with Nayar Lopez from Mexico. Well, Nayar, we're observing the interference from the United States, but also the ongoing crisis within the multilateral movements and organizations. This constant crisis, along with many others, often arises from shifts in social systems or changes in government direction. Although there are sometimes disagreements within multilateral movements, for example, the BRICS, which we can categorize as part of the multilateralism movement, but anyway, they are seen as a solution, aside from the disagreements within. Recently, there was almost a war between India and Pakistan, with China backing Pakistan, and India is also part of the BRICS, as is China, which is significant. What I mean to convey is that multilateralism is the solution to the issues faced by nations striving for sovereignty, independence, self-determination, and ultimately confronting imperialism, breaking free from the clutches of imperialism. What do you think?
Salir de las garras del imperialismo o una parte de aquello?
Yo pensaría que es una parte de aquello en la medida en que finalmente los mecanismos multilaterales que hemos conocido.
I think, unlike other versions of it, that is the European Union, the multilateral mechanisms that we have known have not yet reached an integration that, while respecting national sovereignties, play roles in a much higher tier than the multilateral mechanisms. I mean, they have numerous untapped potentials. In other words, scenarios like CELAC, BRICS, UNASUR, and ALBA have limitations in that they don't propose a restructuring of the international economic order, nor do they necessarily aim to overcome the capitalist system that is leading humanity to disaster. Instead, they have established different areas of collaboration, cooperation, exchange, and trade. Even so advanced that we could say they are considering a currency alternative to the hegemonic dollar, as seen in the case of BRICS, or particularly Russia and Iran have common currency for all types of trade. So I believe this is part of the political processes within countries that accompany this new way of understanding international relations, particularly multilateralism, towards mechanisms that ensure strong structures against what the American empire represents. I think they go hand in hand, but the extent or the main objective will determine the outcome. As you rightly pointed out, a center government, a leftist one or a right-wing one, can significantly influence how much a country participates in that multilateral scenario, or how much it even withdraws, like the despicable Bolsonaro did when he suspended Brazil from CELAC at the time, or when they created that blatantly unconditional experiment of the United States called PROSUR, which supposedly aimed to find alternatives for their countries, but in reality, it was about sabotage, and they ultimately succeeded in that regard.
That's right. Nayar, let me give you the following example. In Chile, there is some debate about whether or not to join the BRICS. And it's interesting to see that there are sectors of the upper bourgeoisie that even view joining the BRICS positively. The question is, who benefits from fairer trade and more reciprocal relationships rather than subjugation? How does that translate to the people, to the sectors that are currently marginalized, or continue to earn the same as always, as long as there is no change in social organization or a different political direction in the country? So yes, these organizations are good, but it depends on who is in government, don't you think?
Por supuesto.
Sí, no, totalmente de acuerdo con tu planteamiento porque...
I completely agree with your perspective as it mirrors the situation in Mexico. In other words, we have a government that has been promoting some very significant initiatives, such as the recent election of the judiciary, which is a landmark event in the region, alongside Bolivia, which has been doing this for some time. However, the internal economic order remains just as it was during the neoliberal era. To put it differently, macroeconomics is the crucial element that needs attention. While there is social redistribution through various programs, the capitalist system persists unchanged, and we still have a small portion of the society earning $1 million every hour. Contrasted with 50 million people living in poverty and facing inequality, as well as the violence we are experiencing in our country, for instance. Indeed, the scenario you present is the same. Being part of the BRICS does contribute to reorganization, so to speak, of international economic relations, reducing the influence and significance of the United States in these relationships. However, if the international economic order itself is not altered, if the capitalist system is not changed at both the national and global levels, then the social conditions in our nations will not fundamentally improve. There may be social programs, scholarships, and various initiatives that can serve as temporary relief or be seen as redistribution, but ultimately, the root causes of inequality and marginalization inherent in capitalism in countries like ours remain unaddressed. In this regard, I believe that while all these mechanisms are indeed beneficial and important, they must also reflect a deeper internal change in our countries through structural reforms, rather than relying solely on good social policies, which could easily be dismantled by a right-wing government, leaving everything unchanged.
Puede venir un gobierno de derecha a desmontar toda esa estructura y no pasó nada, ¿no?
Así es. Ahora,
that's right. Now, is there a reference point, for instance, with the experience of the non-aligned countries at that time, that movement? Can we discuss multilateralism during that period?
Yes, of course. I believe it was a very significant experience that reflected how a strong alliance was empowered, let's say, among countries that shared similar political, economic, and social realities. And additionally, it occurred during a time when this intense phase of colonialism was also coming to an end, although it hasn't completely finished, as there are still 20 territories in the Caribbean under neocolonial conditions. However, at that time, the non-aligned movement represented the possibility of coexistence among nations without the dominance of the two power poles that existed back then, one of which is now clearly identified as the United States. This bears some resemblance, for instance, to BRICS, but I think the current mechanism that best embodies the spirit of the non-aligned movement, even reflecting what the Mutual Economic Assistance Agreement represented in the socialist bloc, is ALBA. To me, ALBA represents the Bolivarian alternative for the peoples of our America, fully known as the Treaty of Commerce of the Peoples. It seems to me to be the most advanced multilateral mechanism and is for integration in the world, to the extent that it is not a mechanism that serves the economic interests of imperialism, but rather the social development of peoples and the reduction of asymmetries between countries.
Y para la disminución de las asimetrías entre países, ¿no?
Así es. Nayar, en una palabra para terminar.
That's right, Nayar. To sum it up, in one word, what does the future hold for the multilateralism movement?
Multilateralismo.
I believe it holds great promise. There are numerous opportunities to reshape power structures globally within a context of reciprocity, cooperation, solidarity, and respect. It's not about a relationship where military bases are used to coerce acceptance of a trade agreement, but rather about relationships where countries can engage in exchange and, most importantly, adopt a social perspective. That's how I see it.
Well, Nayar Lopez, a big hug to you. Thank you so much for being with us here on Black and White.
Likewise, Eduardo. It's my pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Tales full of sadness and woe, but I believe you smile again. You see, I know the pain you're feeling, 'cause I was there just like you. Like you'll be outcast. Sometimes it's better to be alone than to be with the bad crowd. Preserve your mind and feed it. Nourish what it is you have inside. Use it in the right way. Oh,
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, you know, in these programs or series of episodes called Islamic Laws, we normally choose a topic and, talk about some of the jurisprudential laws related to that, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And one of these topics is actually socializing or interaction, basically, or interacting with the non-Muslims. I'm talking about the Muslims interacting with non-Muslims, right? Is it permissible, Sheikh Javi, to, for example, import Israeli goods and products and advertise them? If there's no other choice, is it permissible to sell such goods?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, when it comes to interacting with non-Muslims, of course, we have to understand that, generally speaking, it's okay to interact with non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes.
Muslims living in the West, Muslims living in Europe, in
yes.
the United States of America and Australia. Okay, they have to interact with non-Muslims.
Yes.
Okay, they have to have give and take relationships. Like you work in their factories,
mm-hmm.
you earn
yes.
For your family.
Yes.
And yes, you have to interact. Otherwise, life will be like hell. It
mm-hmm.
will be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the illegitimate government of Israel, and this is quite different.
Mm-hmm.
We see that Israel has been occupying the land of Palestinians for more than 75 years, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And they continue to their acts of aggression and atrocities, especially in recent years. In the past 2 years, we see that they have been killing thousands and thousands of innocent Palestinians, without discriminating between children and men and women. So they kill relentlessly. And without even other countries like the European countries or the United States of America objecting to what is going on. And this is the atrocity that has been going on, unfortunately. Even some neighboring Arab countries are not doing enough to stop the aggressions. So we see that with the help of some countries,
mm.
Israel is relentlessly killing the Palestinians. If it were not for the support of the other countries,
mm.
Israel would not have stood up or would not have been able to attack Muslims and occupy the Palestinian land, occupy the Syrian land. And they are occupying with the help of the United States of America and other countries,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately. So it is forbidden to embark on any dealings that may serve the interests of the usurping state of Israel, which harbors enmity towards Islam and Muslims. And it is not permissible for anyone to import, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, to import and promote the Israeli goods and the Israeli production. And it's also not permissible to sell any of the Israeli any manufactured goods, okay, whether it is manufactured inside Israel or manufactured by any other companies outside
mm.
the outside Israel,
yes,
that support Israel and that keep and allocate part of its income to support Israel, it's not permissible to buy any of those companies' items. So it's not permissible for Muslims to buy such goods, and because it entails bad effects and is, of course, detrimental to Islam and Muslims.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to dealing with the non-Muslims on the part of the Muslims, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, before the break, you said that it is impermissible to actually work with or trade in Israeli goods, right?
Right.
But what about distinguishing the Jews from the Israeli, right? The government of Israel, the country, and the Jews. How about dealing with the Jews, basically?
Well, Muslims are not opposed to the Jews. Jews are the people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Jews in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they are living their lives normally.
And in the Muslim countries as well.
In Muslim countries also.
Yes.
The problem that Muslims have is with the Israeli state, the Jewish state of Israel. And it is ruled by a few, extremist Jews who we call Zionists. They are the ones who have occupied illegitimately the land of Palestinians, and they are the ones who are responsible for the killing and murder and massacre of Palestinians and their lands.
Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for merchants and traders to import and promote Israeli goods in a country that has lifted the boycott of Israeli goods?
No, it's not permissible. Why is it not permissible? Because by purchasing their goods, we actually help them. Yes, and it would benefit the state of Israel if we buy their goods, because their factories, their companies will be strengthened by our money, by our resources. So we should boycott the Israelis, and all Muslims across the world should boycott the Israeli goods and the Israeli companies, and not buy anything from them and from any countries which import the Israeli goods.
Mm, I see. Okay, I think we better actually take a break, because my next question is somehow in two parts, and it may actually entail some more or detailed and lengthy explanation. So let's take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma صل على محمد
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. What's the next program? I'm Sheikh Chabid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to interaction with the non-Muslims on the part of the Muslims according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Chabid, before the break, I promised our listeners to ask, a two-part question. The first part of this question is related to this notion that is it permissible to set up travel agencies in Muslim lands with a view to selling tickets for traveling to Israel? And the second part of my question is related to those people who want to, like the customers who want to buy these tickets, all right?
Right.
Is it permissible for Muslims to buy such tickets from such agencies?
Well, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, it is not permissible to set up such agencies. And to buy, you see, tickets from such agencies, because it is detrimental to Islam and Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not permissible for anyone to do anything that may constitute a violation of the Muslims' boycott of Israel. You know, all Muslims across the world are supposed to boycott Israeli goods.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, to a large extent, we see generally Muslims living in in Muslim countries.
Yes.
Generally do not buy mm-hmm. Israeli goods
mm-hmm.
because they know that if they buy the Israeli goods, they will contribute to some kind of crime.
Yes.
And the atrocities that are being committed upon the innocent Palestinians. So Muslims do not buy. Okay, but when it comes to those travel agencies, again, this is the answer goes like the answer I gave earlier, that buying their tickets from their travel agencies, which sell tickets for Israel as the destination, okay, mm-hmm. will help the Israeli travel agencies and will help their tourism industry, and it will have positive effects on the Israeli economy. We should not do any of this.
Let me ask you a question in a similar vein. Is it permissible, Sheikh, to buy the products of Jewish, American, or Canadian companies if there is a probability that they are supportive of Israel?
Well, if the proceeds from the sale and purchase of these goods would contribute to supporting the occupying and illegitimate state of Israel, or to opposing Islam and Muslims, it is not permissible for anybody to buy or sell such things. And otherwise, it is quite permissible, you know. Jewish companies, American companies, Canadian companies that do not support the Israeli government, okay, in any manner. So there's no problem in buying them as long as we know that, for example, the proceeds do not go to Israel
mm-hmm.
or to any Israeli companies which yes. support the Israeli state, mm-hmm. The illegitimate state of Israel.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chabid, and thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to actually delve into some of the jurisprudential laws related to Muslims' interactions with the non-Muslim, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And until another show, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو الوحيد القدير. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
There are journalists who excel at presenting intricate global affairs with clarity, offering fresh perspectives on the stories that shape our world. Their investigative work often challenges dominant narratives, opening doors to deeper understanding. My guest today is one such individual who has dedicated her career to uncovering the truth behind complex international issues, producing thought-provoking and influential reports that resonate with audiences worldwide. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Roy, your host. Anya Parampil is an American journalist known for her work with RT America and The Gray Zone. She has gained recognition for her investigative reporting and coverage of international affairs. Her journalism often focuses on geopolitical issues and has brought her into the spotlight for interviews and collaborations with prominent figures.
The world war that we are going to experience, or that we are experiencing in our generation, is not this of the same nature as the world wars past. There's not trenches. The nature of the war is different. The battle is different. It's a hybrid war. They have economic sanctions that they levy as part of this war. They wage a media war through your mind now, not just on the television, but through social media as well. And there's a proxy war. There's a covert aspect, which is what we're seeing play out in Ukraine. And when we are clear about those objectives and about the stakes, it's not so hard to put away our differences and to come together and rage against the war machine. So thank you all for doing it. Thank you for letting me speak. Thank you to Nick and Angela once again. And no more war!
Ms. Anya Parampil, it's so good to have you on SORP.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be in Tehran and to explore this country.
Lovely to hear that. I was really impressed with the fact that you wrote a book on the Venezuelan crisis and the failed coup. And, of course, I would love to have a copy of that if you can arrange that. Tell me about the situation in Gaza now and the role of international institutions and organizations. Of course, what we are witnessing is a total failure of the international system. It is broken. It cannot everybody individually, individual governments are coming out and saying that this is horrendous, what is happening in Gaza, especially the blockade of aid. Mm-hmm. Right now, more than 2 months, we are into that. But how can we fix that? How can the world fix that?
Gaza does represent the ultimate failure of this world, that even when we talk about the economic sense, this is the world order that has been established since World War II, when we were told never again, that this was all established to prevent what happened in Gaza. I think that this live-streamed Holocaust, which is worse than anything humans have lived through in history, at the time World War II or previous conflicts, we never were waking up every day while it was happening to see it, to see the children, to see the families torn apart. And so, in fact, many people didn't know in the past when these things were going on, so there was more of a, looking back on history, there was at least a reason or excuse that it could have gone on. Now there's no excuse. People know, they saw, and so we have to question, why was this allowed to happen? Well, institutions like the UN, I think that I've defended in the past, or I see as valuable as a place for the world to come together and speak, and based on the principles of territorial integrity, political independence, and sovereignty, great. But then we remember the UN was the institution that established Israel in the first place. So those principles were never on the table for Palestinians. And now we see that when it comes to this concept of never again, the UN completely failed. They can talk all day, but if the UN were truly going to serve its purpose, there should have been a force to stop the Israelis immediately after we saw a few weeks of the devastation in Gaza. And so it's clear that the UN and other institutions that were established at that time are there to support this world order. And I think that when we talk about a rising multipolar world or the inevitability, what is that inevitability based on? To me, it's that all people want to be sovereign. They want to be independent. They don't want to be living under the boot of an imperial power. And that, of course, applies most of all to the Palestinians. That is their only crime, is simply wanting their land and their homes. And so they are the distillation of this crisis of the New World Order or the rules-based international order that you hear Blinken and the liberal establishment speak of. And so for the world now to see, I think it's going to be the nail in the coffin of that system. And Israel, I think, probably wrote its own death certificate. Again, we don't know how long it will take, but I do think that ultimately Israel can't recover from this, just the same way that the international system cannot recover from this.
And what will be the change that will come after that? Because, of course, we are all seeing the signs here, and the people, when I talk to our reporters on the ground in Gaza, they're all saying that, well, what ICJ is doing is impressive, but nobody even cares here anymore. Everybody right. wants meaningful action. So how do you think this meaningful action will come?
Unfortunately, the blow of Syria, for example, and the destruction of other countries that would have been part of the resistance over the last 20 years has contributed to a feeling that there's no one. Now you have Trump there's Iran, of course, but because of this dynamic now in its own conflict with the United States. So when Trump comes to the Middle East, unfortunately, he gives this speech that in some ways I thought was excellent, talking about neocons having wrecked more countries than they've built and intervening in complex situations that they didn't understand. Then he said, the people of the region built this region, and that is what is a beautiful thing. But he's talking about these fake Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar. These are not the people of the region. These are not they're kind of all of an invented people, especially when you look at the smaller Gulf states. So he's not talking about the Arabs and the Iranians who actually have centuries of civilization and history and a record of building their own region. I wish that that's what he was talking about. But so there's this tension, I think, between, yes, those states and Iran, obviously. But if Israel can wane in its influence, I do see that there's hope that ultimately that even these countries can work together with Iran. In the multipolar world, for a while, it means that there's more instability because you have countries rising up with their own agenda and power that can't be cut down the way that they may have in the past by
like
a strong
tectonic plates.
Exactly. The Pakistan and India is a good example of a place that you might see more tension in this multipolar world because both of those countries are going to assert themselves. Though for now the U.S. was able to say, okay, we're going to cut you off from trade. You better put a stop to this. And they cooled off. There's going to definitely be growing pains. But ultimately, I hope that there will be a stabilization where there's not just one hegemon, but I think the United States will always be a strong player on the international stage, China, Russia, India, and then there will be another wave of countries that are also influential, Iran, Turkey, Venezuela, Mexico, Algeria, South Africa, Egypt, the countries that are rising in BRICS for their importance, and Once we go through those growing pains, I hope there will be more stability. And I hope the U.S. decides to just participate in that world as equals rather than try to undermine it, because it's not going to work out for anyone if we continue down that path.
Right. And I want to focus a little bit now on the U.S.-Israeli relationship, because even mainstream media are saying nowadays, as we speak now in May 2025, they're saying that there is a break and between the U.S. and Israel, especially over the Iran issue. Do you think that is true, or is it just mind games?
I think that it has to be true to a degree. If I'm in the position of Donald Trump, and what we know about Trump is that even maybe just from a narcissistic perspective, he would like to be remembered in history as a positive figure. He would like to be remembered as a deal maker. I don't think he would like to be remembered as the one who went to war with Iran and destroyed the United States. I think the United States would face an absolute internal crisis if it went to war with Iran. We have not experienced the level of military response in a conflict that we would experience if we engaged with Iran for decades. If we got body bags sent back to the United States the way that we would if this terrible situation, if the Israelis had their way, played out, there would be internal strife in the United States that would maybe destabilize it to the point of no return. And so I think because of the situation with Gaza, because of the situation with Israel having, you know, the neocon doctrine, clean break document from back in the 90s, they've checked off all of their countries, their axis of evil. Iran is the last remaining one. It came to a point when Trump came into office that Israel thought, this is our chance. This is when we're going to make it happen. It's now or never. And Trump is faced with a choice between being possibly the most disastrous president of my lifetime or someone who stood up against it. And I think Trump's own nature is to want negotiation and to say, first of all, I'm the one in charge, not Bibi Netanyahu. And so I think the issue of finding out that his national security advisor, Mike Waltz, was secretly meeting behind his back with Netanyahu in order to make this war happen contributed to a sense that, of pride's sake, Trump can't continue down this path. And so even if I don't love what he's doing with the Saudis right now, I do think that it is a bit of a slap in the face to Israel. And so I think that's positive. And from what I see in consuming U.S. media, I do think the rift is real, because I see that the Trump surrogates are speaking out against Israel for the first time in a way that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you could have never imagined an American politician saying. For example, Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's a representative in the Trump camp, very strong figure in Make America Great Again. She said the other day that the Americans are tired of being lied to and going to war for Israel. This is something amazing to hear from a Republican politician. Matt Gaetz, who Trump originally selected as his attorney general, also recently went on a podcast and said, it's a little strange if whether you're on the right or the left, if you make legitimate criticisms of the Israeli government, they call you anti-Semitic, and that you have to toe a certain line from both parties on Israel. For these truths to be said out loud to me suggests that, yes, this rift is real, and Americans cannot tolerate this anymore. For all of the money that they've put in, the Adelsons, the main Zionist donors,
right,
they can't compete with the fact that the grassroots base of Trump, the youth, are totally over with Israel. Even the evangelical Christians, the young ones, they don't support Israel in the same way that the older baby boomer generation does. Right now, polls say that over 60% of American Republicans do not want war with Iran. Uh-huh. And 10 years ago, those people would have been more susceptible to propaganda, and they're not now. I don't think you can undo that. And so I'm hopeful. It's going to take a lot of work, and there's a lot of darkness that comes when you start to talk about the Israeli situation. Even the truth about the JFK files, for example, when Trump declassified some of those, we started to see Israel mentioned a lot more when it came to that plot. So that's what you're dealing with when you start to question the Israeli special relationship, but again, I think it's inevitable. We cannot continue to be this way. I mean, whether it's our speech rights at home being taken away on behalf of these this foreign government.
Yes, of course, we're seeing the universities.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's interesting to see Trump's base even complaining about, they said we wanted deportations, but not for this. We wanted, you know, to look at this crisis that we had of millions of people coming across the border and disappearing into the country. We weren't worried about university students writing op-eds about Israel while here on legitimate visas and green cards. It's exposing the level of control to a point that Americans have never really seen before. And in that way, once you rip the mask off and you see the ugly monster, people are going to want to put it down.
Right. And one could say, despite all the casualties in Gaza, taking into account the big picture, we could see that this entire thing is backfiring against Israel. But could we see a similar move, meaningful move, by the U.S. government regarding Gaza, trying to disblockade and a war there?
I think that we're unfortunately taking baby steps. At this point, we're dealing with rhetoric and just trying to stop the escalation of the situation with Iran. But of course, if Trump really wanted to make a deal, tomorrow he could say he's ending aid to Israel and force them to let aid across the border. But we're not there yet, unfortunately. I don't think the bravery or the situation isn't prepared for that level, and that's disappointing to me because, of course, it's nice to talk about all the theories of the changing world, but when there are people suffering at the level there is in Gaza, it's pretty hard to tolerate. And there's this feeling of helplessness that I've even struggled with personally since this war began.
All of us, I think. And as an investigative journalist, how do you pick your topics to work on?
Usually it comes from conversations with people, a source or someone that might have information, and they share it with me, and then I just go down a rabbit hole. Since I became a mother, I kind of had to slow down because the rabbit hole can be never-ending and it can kind of be all-consuming. So I'm more focused on a family these days. But usually it's, or if I have a question, if I notice something about the way that news is being presented on the mainstream, and I see something else through my international networks, you know, friends in Iran or elsewhere that are showing another side, then I kind of have to try and find the information to present. We say that the gray zone is trying to break the media blockade in the United States, that in the U.S. we just have one view presented. So sometimes they make that job pretty easy. For example, the way that they attack Iran is so extreme that it's pretty easy to tell the other side. All you have to do is show up here and show the reality of life. And sometimes something as simple as that can make a big difference in the United States because we are lied to so much. In Venezuela, too, we were told that there's no food, everybody's starving, everybody's killing each other and dying. All we had to do was go there and film the reality to make a big impact. Here they say, you know, that there are no religious minorities or that women are treated terribly. All we had to do was come here and film religious minorities and women walking in the street, or me walking in the street, to show that that's not the case. Sometimes it's more, it takes more of an effort to do an investigation, like I said, with documents, court documents, or sometimes focusing on an individual character. That's something I did a lot with my book, was taking the individuals who were leading the coup and going into their background deep. And then the story kind of emerges that they're all tools of the United States.
I see. That is very interesting. And of course, research is a huge part of your work as an investigative journalist. And mainstream media try to get you far and away from true material. How do you kind of make your way through and find them?
Just, I mean, the internet has given us great resources, and for all the faults of X and the problems with it that are clear, it has also served as a great tool for connecting people around the world. Traveling to places and meeting people, that to me is the greatest key. That's the greatest source of information, is people to people.
Anya, this is really interesting. We're going to talk about it some more, but after a quick break. Well, we're approaching the end of our program. Anya, I don't know, time really flies. I really did not realize the passing of time because I wanted to keep talking to you for hours. I really enjoyed this conversation. We are at the end of our show. We have about a minute. Take your time, talk to the camera right behind me and straight to our audience.
Well, it has been such a pleasure and a privilege to come to Iran and to see the reality of people here. And I just hope that you understand that our government in the United States is not the same as the people. The people absolutely want peace. I think even now, many in our government want peace. And so that is what the message that I will take back to the United States from here is that there is no enemy in Iran. And we could actually be friends and live in a totally functional, happy world where everybody's having mutually beneficial arrangements and agreements. And the greatest obstacle to that is, unfortunately, my country and some foreign influence in my country that we are working to reveal. But I think that the inevitable human nature is that we're all going to find ourselves in a more sovereign, more politically independent, and happy world, because at the end of the day, I think we all want the same thing, which is a better life for our children. And so we're going to work to strive to make that happen in the United States. And I know that the brave Iranian people will do the same.
Thank you, Anya. It was a pleasure to talk to you here at SORP. I really wanted this conversation to go on, but we are at the end of the program. And thank you so much. This is the end of another SORP. But remember, SORP means only the beginning of the day. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Nurai.
Cause you mean everything. Hear you talking when you're sleeping. Reality, know you're going through hardship. And I know that you're scared, but you don't need to worry, cause Allah is there. Ooh, oh, I will never let you go. You're my heart, my life, my soul. And the choices that we make, we gotta make our own. Gotta stand on our feet. Take this direction. When we take on the world, all the diamonds and pearls, couldn't take me away from your smile and your love.